Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're back live on Monday Night Raw with Titus O'Neil.
Now, earlier tonight, you guys heard that the New Day talking about winning the WWE Tag Team Champions, becoming the WWE Tag Team Champions.
For God's sake, turn it off! Turn it off!
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 458 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, August 28, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. SummerSlam weekend is in the books. It's a busy, busy week. A lot of content, a lot of new audio went up over the last week. I want to take a moment here to thank Noah Mark for securing the studio space that we were able to use last weekend at Sirius XM to record episode 457. We took your phone calls on that show. So if you want to go back in the archives and check that out, I like that show a lot. I thought it was one of the better shows. Just a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll do more of those in the future. I also want to take a moment to thank Jamie with Mania Crawl. I was going to say Wrestle Crawl. With Mania Crawl, we partnered up for the meetup last Sunday at the Beer Hall in Brooklyn a few hours before SummerSlam. We raised money for Connor's Cure. We had the legend himself, Bill After, there as our guest of honor, signing books and mingling with people. Bill's a great guy, one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And hopefully me and Jamie, you know, we'll do more stuff in the future. It was a big success. I want to thank everybody who came out. I met a ton of people. Just talking and interacting with people pretty much for 4.5 hours nonstop, to the point where I missed the first two matches on the SummerSlam pre-show, although that's what happens when they turn their pre-show into a two-hour affair. It was like 5 straight hours of wrestling that night, which is just way too much. But I enjoyed meeting everybody, and we are going to do another meetup in Orlando. We'll probably do a live show again / meetup like we did in Dallas this year. We'll do that for WrestleMania next year in Orlando. And if, in fact, they are back in New York for SummerSlam weekend next year, which I think they are, we'll definitely have to do something like this again. So thank you to everybody who came out. Thank you also to Zane Decker and Strong Style Studios for the video they shot at our meetup. Zane interviewed me. He interviewed a lot of you for the video. It's up on our YouTube channel right now. It's about 3.5 minutes long if you want to check it out. It's got some highlights from the meetup and everything that was going on that weekend. Bill After is in the video. So check that out. Before we move on, I have to show some love for Audible, which continues to support this podcast and offer listeners of this show a trial of its audiobook service, free for 30 days. You could sign up right now using our link, which is audibletrial.com/solomonster. If you use our link and you sign up, you won't be billed. You can sample the service for 30 days. They have over 180,000 audiobook titles for you to choose from if audiobooks are your thing. If you've never tried an audiobook before, give it a shot. You know, you might like it. You can listen to it on the go, at the gym. You want to kill some time on your commute or what have you. They have a ton of wrestling books up there, some that I've recommended. Bob Holly's book is now available through Audible. It's one of the best wrestling books out there. Chris Jericho's book, I think it's either his second or third, is up on the service as well. Daniel Bryan, who in one of the versions that's up there, I know he narrates it. Brock Lesnar's book, Bill After's book, narrated by Bill himself. He spent 19 hours in studio recording voiceovers for his audiobook. So all of that is up there, and you get one free book. So if before the 30 days are up, you know, you're like, I don't know if I want to continue this, it's not my thing, you can cancel, you won't be billed. That book belongs to you. You don't have to give it back. It's kind of hard to do, I guess, once you've listened to it anyway. So anyway, audibletrial.com/solomonster. I want to end this year on a high note. We're getting very close to the end of the year here. It's hard to believe. So support the show, use our link, spread it around, and take advantage of that. Also, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, if you do like what you hear every week, want to hear your name shouted out on a podcast that is listened to by a lot of people all over the world. You can make a donation of $10 or more, get your wrestling nickname and a shout out here on the show. I want to say thank you to our VIPs for this week. John Loose Cannon Lopez, of course. Russell the Muscle. Misfit Miguel Mendoza. Yvonne Bruiser Balak. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Nemesis Nathan Moyers. Alvin Chainsaw Siegerts. Quick Draw Benjamin Quesnel. The Chosen Son Andre Smith. Ladies Man Levi Daly. Case Closed Aaron Kloss. Kind of a Big Deal Corey Blake. The Newport Nightmare, Adam Grendel, Soldier of Fortune, Umair Khan, David the Boss Price, John Mudslinger Maroney, Breaking Bad Boy, Bryant Guzman. See, he's a Breaking Bad fan. See what I did there? See, Brian, I didn't forget. We talked at the meetup last week. I know you're a big Breaking Bad fan. Nick Kiss My Butt. Butt's his last name. High Roller Rich Crook. I like that. Rich Crook. That's actually his name, too. Rich Crook. How about that? The Chapel Hill High Flyer, Kyle George. Dark Despair, Derek Graziano, who hosts the Sometimes Geek podcast, which started as a weekly call between two friends ranting about video games. Now it's a podcast. You can find them at sometimesgeek.podbean.com, as well as on iTunes. So thank you to everybody who made a donation, I very much appreciate it. You can always do so on thesolemonster.com. You'll see the PayPal donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can give whatever you want, whenever you want. It's the quickest and best way to show your support for this podcast. We don't have any other sort of crowdfunding page, not yet anyway, or anything like that set up. So PayPal is probably the way to go. But there's lots of different ways to show your support. So, thank you. NXT TakeOver Brooklyn was last Saturday. SummerSlam, of course, was last Sunday. I merged the two. One giant review. It's about an hour long. It's up on our YouTube channel right now, so I'm not going to get into the shows. If you want to hear my thoughts on them, you got to go on there. There is a downloadable MP3 version if you want to listen to it that way. You got to get the link in the video description. Always remember when I do reviews like that, if you know, you're worried that, well, if I don't push it out to the feed, how am I going to listen to it? I don't want to listen to it on YouTube. For all of the event reviews, there's always an MP3 link in the download or in the description if you want to download it. So that's where you can find that. There's actually a ton of new content on the YouTube channel, including all the interviews I did at the 2K17 launch party, many of which you heard on episode 457, but I put them all in one place. So my interview with AJ Styles and Nakamura and The Miz, which we'll talk about The Miz later. Charlotte, Sasha Banks, all of that is up there on the channel. The highlights video from our meetup that I mentioned, and a brand new Sound Off Gamer, or as I'm calling it, Forearm City, bitch. With me playing as Chris Jericho against Brock Lesnar inside of a steel cage. You know, I tried to put the advice that AJ Styles gave me when I interviewed him to good use, and I actually practiced a little bit before playing this time. And speaking of Jericho against Lesnar, that is the perfect segue into our first story here. I talked about this in the 2K16 video as I was playing. I was actually discussing this story, so you might want to go on the YouTube channel and listen to that as well. But basically what happened is Jericho and Lesnar got into a little bit of a scuffle. After the pay-per-view ended last Sunday, Jericho was trying to find out what the finish was. Was that the planned finish of Orton and Lesnar? He's very concerned about what happened to Randy. Nobody would tell him anything. Michael Hayes wouldn't tell him, and he got very upset. He said, this is bullshit. At the exact moment that Brock came backstage, and Brock overheard this, and Brock basically told him to mind your own business. You're a pussy. He may have used some other unflattering words that would get him in some trouble if they became public. And Jericho wouldn't back down. Jericho got up in his face. I think he may have shoved Lesnar or put his fingers on his forehead and shoved him or something like that. At one point, Lesnar said, either punch me or kiss me. Brock doesn't give a fuck. But apparently neither does Jericho. And Jericho already had something of a rep. You know, he had put Bill Goldberg in a front face lock, supposedly, in a backstage fight that got quickly broken up back when Goldberg first came over to WWE, and that stemmed from some heat between them going back to the WCW days when Goldberg wouldn't work with Jericho. And So Jericho is not the kind of person that's just going to kind of cower and back down. And he got up in Lesnar's face, and that could have ended very, very badly. Triple H got between them. That still wasn't enough. Vince McMahon himself had to get between them. I'm very surprised that because what happened was, you know, Vince got between them and was yelling at Jericho to the point where Triple H had to kind of defend Jericho and say, well, Brock started it, but, you know, Vince is basically yelling at Jericho, it's a work, what the hell's wrong with you? Be a professional. So I'm surprised that Jericho, you know, assuming all of this is true, I'm surprised that Jericho would let himself get worked up like that, or get worked like that. Yeah, he's been around for quite a while. Just the visual of Vince McMahon getting between these two guys and screaming at Jericho, it's a work, what the hell is wrong with you, is just hilarious to me. From the sounds of it, very few people knew what the finish was going in. Lesnar and Orton obviously did. Paul Heyman might have. But supposedly the referee only knew that Brock was winning. He knew nothing beyond that. It's kind of like the story they've told about the Lesnar-Undertaker match at WrestleMania 30. This seems like a Brock Lesnar thing, where they keep these finishes very, very tight-knit, very close to the vest between Vince, Brock, and maybe a couple of other people at the most. To the point where even the referee, when he goes out to the ring, and imagine the referee, and I think the referee might have been Chad Patton in that Lesnar-Undertaker match. I would have shit myself. Can you imagine that? I mean, the Undertaker is at that point, what is he, 21-0 at WrestleMania. And I don't know what the referee knew or didn't know in terms of, did he know at least that Brock was winning? My understanding of it, as the story's told, is that he didn't know anything. I don't even think he knew that Brock was supposed to win, let alone how. And so imagine if you're the referee in that match, you're pretty much just, you know, you're going by a cue in your ear or maybe something that Brock says or however it worked, and you count that fall. I mean, you got to be shitting a brick at that point if you don't know what's going on. So this is not the first time we've heard a story about the referee not even knowing the extent of, hey, what's going to happen here. So he may have known that Brock was going to win. He didn't know how. He didn't know that Orton was going to get busted open the way he was. And this is all according to the latest Observer. Randy Orton knew what was coming. He wasn't expecting it to be quite that vicious. Brock is just treated differently than everybody else there. That's just the way it is. Nobody else is allowed to get blood in their matches. I mean, it happens accidentally, but this was intentional. So for the people wondering, oh, was this a shoot? Was this a work? I mean, this was all part of the plan. The plan was to get some blood on Randy Orton. And you would not see that. That would not be allowed in anyone else's match. But Brock, you know, he's allowed to get blood in his matches, and nobody else can get away with dropping an S-bomb in their promos the way Brock did a few weeks ago with Heath Slater. Supposedly that was an unscripted line. It was a great line. I don't give a shit about your kids. But nobody else would be able to get away with that. If you even tried, you know, you'd be out the door so quick your head would spin. You know, but Brock can get away with it. And Vince, I guess. Vince dropped an F-bomb earlier this year before WrestleMania on Raw, but I doubt he punished himself for it. Nobody else is booked as strongly in their matches as Brock is. I mean, think about it. Brock Lesnar has now destroyed two of the top babyfaces in the company at SummerSlam. He absolutely destroyed John Cena 2 years ago. Orton got some more offense here than Cena did, but he still got wrecked in this match, and the match had to be called off by a stoppage. And I mean, Orton and Cena are two of the biggest stars in the company ever, not just in the last decade plus, but ever. And Brock just utterly demolished them, just total annihilation. The wellness policy, we already know he's treated differently just by virtue of being a part-timer. You know, he gets preferential treatment. That's just how it is. And I'm sure that rubs a lot of guys there the wrong way. I mean, how could it not? How could that not rub guys there the wrong way? You don't need to be an insider. You don't need to be a fly on the fucking wall in the locker room to know that there's a lot of guys in that company, mid-card guys, I'm sure, who look at this as a double standard and go, this is bullshit. Now, was that part of why Jericho got so upset? You know, did he fly off on Lesnar because he's felt the same way and all these things just sort of bubbled up? I don't know. I mean, it may well have been. It's very clear they're building Lesnar for Roman Reigns. You know, Brock's been so built up so strong now that realistically there isn't anyone else on that roster who could beat this guy. Believably beat this guy. Roman Reigns is the closest one. I know that's not what a lot of people want to hear, but he's the closest thing to somebody who can realistically and reasonably take down Brock Lesnar. He went apeshit on Rusev at the pay-per-view. He was a madman. That's the Roman Reigns that we need to see more of if the plan is for him to beat the Beast at WrestleMania, which I assume it is. There's no one else. There's no one else. I mean, look at the roster right now. Forget Samoa Joe and Nakamura. We don't even know when they're going to get called up to the main roster. And Samoa Joe, by the way, as much as I'd love to see Joe and Lesnar, and I think it would be a really fun match to watch, they ain't putting Samoa Joe over Brock Lesnar. So you can forget about that. Samoa Joe is not the guy they're going to pick at whatever age he is and all that to be the one to beat the Beast. That just ain't going to happen. So take those two and put them on the side for a second. Look at the Raw and SmackDown rosters right now and tell me who could believably be put in a WrestleMania match with Brock Lesnar and beat the man. Braun Strowman? I mean, you never know if somebody might catch fire or not. I mean, they're doing a great job just feeding guys to him so far. But Braun Strowman beating Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania, it's going to take a lot to get him to that point where people would take that seriously, would take him seriously as an opponent for Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania. I don't see it. But you know what? It's still early. There's still a long time between now and WrestleMania. And, you know, so far so good with Braun Strowman. He's not doing much. I can't really sit here and judge, oh, he's improved so much. I've seen so little from this guy. It doesn't take a whole lot to come out and chokeslam people on their face. We got to see more from this guy. We got to hear from him. You know, talk to me in 3 months. Maybe my opinion on Braun Strowman has changed. I look at that right now and I say that would be a disaster. So Reigns is the only one. I'm not saying I want to see it, but there's not a doubt in my mind that he's the guy that they're still grooming for that spot. It didn't happen at 31 like they wanted it to, but I think it probably happens at 33. And Brock, by the way, Brock was temporarily suspended by the Nevada State Athletic Commission this week until he gets a full hearing on his drug test failures. Apparently the maximum suspension that he's facing is not 2 years. If he is suspended, the max, I guess, would be 1 year. So, you know, he may yet fight again if he wants to. I guess we'll see how that shakes out. The other big story this week was Finn Balor. Finn Balor, he has been on quite the roller coaster. He made his debut on Raw on his birthday only a few weeks ago, about a month ago now, and immediately was just propelled into the SummerSlam main event, wrestling for the championship against Seth Rollins. And they had their match at SummerSlam, and unfortunately Balor, while he did win the championship, and it should have been his big crowning moment, he flew his parents in from Ireland, and they were sitting there in the front row. Balor got hurt early in that match, and it was a serious injury. He got buckle-bombed into the barricade. He put his arm out to kind of brace himself when he shouldn't have, and he fucked up his arm. Very much fucked up his shoulder. And the doctor who performed surgery, he had to forfeit the championship the night after. So imagine that. You know, you win this championship, it's this brand-new title, and less than 24 hours later, you're walking out there. You're still the new kid on the block here. And already you're giving this thing up. Vacant has reared his ugly head. Vacant has taken his rightful place once again as a champion in WWE. And the next day you're in surgery. You're in Alabama, I guess, Birmingham, having surgery. And the doctor who performed the surgery had this to say. He said, Finn's injury was pretty severe. More severe than normal. A really high energy injury. It did more damage than a standard shoulder dislocation where you simply tear the labrum. The prognosis is excellent, however. We were able to fix it all and put it all back where it came from. I am anticipating him getting back at full speed. So he dislocated his shoulder. He immediately popped it back in and wrestled the rest of the match. So the guy's a fucking beast. But he also tore his labrum. And I guess, like the doctor said, when they went in there, it was far more severe than they thought. That's a six-month recovery. Although the doctor saying that the injury was more severe than they thought. And also, you know, in another video on their YouTube channel, they actually showed the doctor talking to Finn after the surgery and explaining what they found. He also said when they were in there, they found one of the tendons that attaches his pec to his bicep was just sort of hanging there. Half of it, I think, was torn away. So they had to repair that as well. I don't know what that means as far as his recovery time, but I think 6 months is being optimistic. You know, Hideo Itami had rotator cuff surgery, and it's a different injury, but still, he had shoulder surgery, and I guess it wasn't healing properly. He needed a second surgery, so an injury that should have kept him out for 6 months ended up keeping him out for 18 months. So you never really know with these things. I mean, ideally, Balor would be back as a surprise. Like, if I'm booking this, he's back as a surprise, as the Demon, in the Royal Rumble match. He wins the Rumble. He gets his title back at WrestleMania. That's a good story. He comes back. And we've seen it time and time again. We saw it with Triple H in 2002. Guy comes back from injury, wins the Rumble, fights his way back, wins the championship. We've seen that before. But I think that's a best-case scenario. I mean, I don't know. I feel like even the Rumble is probably too optimistic at this point. Yeah, I feel bad for the guy. I really do. I feel bad for him. This guy spent 2 years in developmental when he didn't even really need to be there. I mean, he finally gets called up. Vince McMahon decides, I'm going to strap the rocket on this guy. Because I saw the reports that I'm sure a lot of you saw this week. I don't remember if it came from the Observer or the Torch or where, but supposedly the original plan had Balor coming up and feuding with Chris Jericho. Jericho wanted to work with him very badly. They were going to feud. They were going to have a SummerSlam match. And it was Vince McMahon's call. He changed direction. He said, we're going to propel this guy. We're going to strap the rocket on his back and launch him, and we're going to put the title on him. I mean, that's a pretty big leap of faith right there. Especially coming from Vince. So they do that, and then this happens. And you know, Daniel Bryan made a great point. He did an interview with Michael Cole on their YouTube channel. And, you know, he was obviously very upset. He was gutted by Finn's injury. He feels for him. And he pointed out that, you know, Finn just turned 35 the day he debuted on Raw. Balor just turned 35 years old. He didn't need to spend all of that time, 2 years plus, in NXT. He said a maximum of 6 months is all he needed to get used to the way that WWE does things and the camera angles and the WWE style. 6 months max is all this guy needed. And, you know, he said he should have been on the main roster a long time ago. Samoa Joe should already be on the main roster. And he's about a year or two older than Balor. Nakamura, he said he should already be on the main roster. He said these guys are in their mid-30s already, and they only have, I think he said they only have so many bumps on their bump card. And he's right. He's right. I thought that was a very valid point that he made. I understand that NXT, they need some names. But to have all of those guys at the same time, it just, especially at a time when they really could have used guys like that on the main roster, and now you have the brand split, and they did call Balor up, and then this happens. It's just a shitty situation. Now, the great debate is, whose fault was it? Was Bret Hart right about Seth Rollins? Is Rollins a dangerous, careless worker? Should the buckle bomb be banned? I thought Bret was being too hard the first time on Seth Rollins, the first time he criticized him all those months ago. You know, because accidents happen. I know he kneed John Cena into oblivion. His face practically exploded. But, it, you know, accidents happen. Okay, you can accept that. Accidents happen. Then Sting got hurt. And he was forced to retire. The two buckle bombs did him in their match at Night of Champions. Rollins hurt himself coming down on his knee. But that was a freak occur. I mean, that could have happened to anybody. So Rollins comes back. And now Balor gets hurt on the same move that he used on Sting. I watched the Balor injury back a whole bunch of times when I got home. He does put his arm out awkwardly when he lands on the barricade. But here's the thing. If he doesn't do that, if he doesn't put his arm out, Rollins, it looks to me like Rollins undershoots him, like he launched him a second or two too early. And Balor's head probably goes into the edge of that barricade instead. So, you know, pick your poison. He could have been seriously fucked up no matter what. He could have injured his neck, suffered a concussion, had he not put his arm out. I think that's probably why he put his arm out. He probably knew, oh shit, you know, I'm going to fall short here. I better protect myself. And unfortunately, he ended up doing, you know, more harm than good. The fact is, I look at this, and, you know, again, I'm not a wrestler. I look at this as a fan. I watch this over and over again, and I say to myself, to me, it looks like they're both at fault for what happened. Balor put his arm out when he shouldn't have. But again, he was only trying to protect himself. And Rollins looked like he launched him too early. He just hurled this guy into the barricade. Either way, Seth Rollins should not be powerbombing people into the barricade outside anymore. I would like to see that stop. I don't know how much give that thing has. It doesn't look like it has a lot of give to it. It's unnecessarily dangerous. Okay, you don't need to be doing that. He should not be doing that. Now, Bret Hart spoke with Nick Houseman of WrestleZone. People were waiting with bated breath, like the jokes and the memes about what's Bret Hart going to say, because he doesn't have a podcast anymore. I don't know why it ended. But people wanted to know what Bret Hart thought. This is what Bret Hart had to say about the whole situation. He said, "I take no great pleasure in saying I told you so, but if you're a professional wrestler and you keep hurting opponents and or yourself, clearly you're doing it wrong. I wrestled a very realistic and physical style, and not one time in 23 years did I ever hurt one opponent ever. Seth Rollins needs to improve his technique and become the safest wrestler in the business. I have great respect for Seth. I believe he'll improve, and hopefully we'll stop hurting the talent before someone gets killed." It's being a little overdramatic, I think. "Wrestlers have to trust one another. If a wrestler holds the life of another in his hands for the sake of his family, wife, or children, you plain and simply cannot drop it. I saw this coming. If anything, WWE producers are negligent for not speaking to him about this already. Instead, they're probably gushing with joy, slapping him on the back and telling him, great job. Bill Goldberg was similar. When I think of Samoa Joe nearly killing Tyson Kidd, then seeing him continuing to use that deadly finish of his, I just shake my head. It's not real. It's only supposed to look real. Wrestlers are not crash test dummies." Okay. Bret Hart is my favorite of all time. I've said that before. If you ask me, Solomonster, who's your favorite wrestler ever? I would probably pick Bret Hart, so I like Bret Hart a lot. But the idea that WWE producers in the back are slapping Rollins on the back and telling him, good job, kid, that is just a ridiculous thing to say. That is completely ridiculous. As is his calling Samoa Joe's muscle buster a deadly finish. Okay, to my knowledge, the only person to ever be injured on a muscle buster is Tyson Kidd, who just so happens to be his niece's husband. So, of course, he's going to be more sensitive to what happened there. Tyson Kidd trained in the dungeon. He's practically just, he's a member of the family. Okay, literally a member of the family. So, of course, Bret is going to be very sensitive to what happened to him. I get that. But I want you to show me evidence of Samoa Joe injuring someone else with the muscle buster, or killing someone with the muscle buster, since according to Bret, it's a deadly finish. He hasn't. There's no evidence of this. At least with Rollins, you know, you could make the argument, this guy got hurt, this guy got hurt, this guy. How can you make that argument with Joe? He's got to chill out on the Samoa Joe bashing. It's disrespectful to Joe. Joe's been doing this a long time. Many, many, many years. Bret himself, the first time he railed on Samoa Joe, the first time he made a comment about him, Bret himself blamed WWE for not giving Tyson Kidd enough time to stretch backstage that night. Like they rushed them out there. There wasn't any time to prepare. So which is it? Did he get hurt because he didn't have time to stretch? Or was it because Samoa Joe is some cold-blooded killer who breaks people's necks and holds their spine in the air like fucking Sub-Zero in Mortal Kombat? You know, you can't have it both ways. But it's like I said with Austin and Ambrose when the podcast aired on the network. And at the very end there, Austin put this guy's the WWE champion. He's supposed to be your top guy. Austin puts him on blast. I think you're resting on your laurels. It's like, what? Why would you say that? Why would you publicly say that? Why not pull the guy aside if you really feel that way and say, hey, listen, this is what I think, you know? To put the guy on blast like that, I didn't think it was right. I thought it was bullshit. And I think, you know, him keep constantly bringing this Samoa Joe thing up here publicly without going to Joe if he feels so strongly about this is also bullshit. Don't you think that if WWE felt that move was so fucking dangerous that after that happened, Samoa Joe would be using the choke or he'd come up with a different finish and we would never see the muscle buster again? Wouldn't logic dictate that to you? Do you think they would let Samoa Joe continue to use that move if they thought that he was reckless or the move itself was so dangerous that people were going to break their neck of all, and a company with all the injuries they've been ravaged by this year, do you honestly think they would let him use the move if they felt that way? I mean, use your head. Now, Brett does make a fair point when it comes to this being the third person who's been hurt wrestling Seth Rollins. You know, maybe somebody does need to sit down with him and talk to him. You know, that's for WWE to decide. Because the last thing they want is for more of their guys to end up on the injured list. This has been one of the worst years for them in terms of injuries. The last thing they need is more bodies to go down. But on this question of should the buckle bomb be banned, the answer is no. The buckle bomb should not be banned. The buckle bomb should not be done outside the ring. I'm in favor of telling him no more of that. You want to tease it, you know, to get, like a big reaction from the crowd. They did that the next night on Raw. He teased doing the same thing to Sami Zayn, and Zayn got out of it. That's fine. But I would tell him, listen, no more throwing people into fucking barricades outside the ring. That's over. Okay, I'm in favor of telling him, don't do that anymore. Keep it inside the ring. But I don't want to see the move banned. Okay, if you go back to Sound Off 357, okay, so go all the way back to November of 2014. I talked about AJ Styles and the Styles Clash. A lot of people were getting hurt taking that move. All of a sudden, AJ Styles was doing the Styles Clash for how many years? All of a sudden, people were getting hurt doing it. Lionheart, this independent wrestler in the UK, he broke his neck taking the Styles Clash. Yoshitatsu in New Japan, he broke his neck. He tucked his chin when he shouldn't have. And he broke his neck, and that was a serious injury. I mean, I remember Yoshitatsu tweeting from the hospital. He was in a fucking halo. He would wake up in agony in the middle of the night. He had blood on his pillow. I mean, he was fucked up. That was a serious injury. Roderick Strong in Ring of Honor, thank God he didn't break his neck, but he tucked his chin when he wasn't supposed to, and he very narrowly avoided injury, taking that move. And so all of a sudden, people were asking, after all these years of AJ Styles, the big, you know, the veteran, using this move, should the Styles Clash be banned? Should AJ Styles retire the Styles Clash? And my answer then, just as it is today, is no. The Styles Clash should not be banned. And I don't even like the Styles Clash. I'm not even a fan of the move. I don't see, you know, what it really does. But I'm not a fan of just arbitrarily banning wrestling moves. It's a slippery slope when you start doing that, you know, because where does it end? Where does it end? Look at the moves we see on TV today. Okay, this ain't 1992 anymore. When the most dangerous move on WWE television was probably the Beverly Brothers Shaker Height Spike, which was an insanely dangerous looking move. Go find the video on YouTube of them doing it to that jobber and spiking him headfirst into the mat. Okay, and tell me that's not a dangerous move. But that move aside, nothing those guys did back then, okay, going back 25 years, looked dangerous. There was no, you know, strong style, I guess, as they call it now, like we see all today, all over the place. I don't know if it's the Japanese influence or what. All the kicks, all the knees, all the strikes that we see today, and you throw Brock Lesnar in there, busting people open with elbows. The style today is a hell of a lot more stiffer, and it looks far more dangerous than it did back then when Bret Hart was first, you know, making it as a single star. Okay, it's why today you've got Daniel Bryan, whether, you know, worked or not, and we'll talk about this later, but you got Daniel Bryan on TV insulting The Miz because I don't like the way you wrestle. You wrestle that safe style. When I was an independent wrestler and we thought, what's the safe WWE or the soft WWE style, I would think of you, Miz. And that was an insult. He used that as an insult on The Miz, that The Miz works a safer, softer style. Apparently that's a bad thing. Okay, that's how people view it. He singles out Miz, and people dislike Miz because he doesn't work the same style that Nakamura works, or that Samoa Joe works, or any of these other guys who really lay their shit in. You know, a lot of them have some pretty dangerous looking moves in their arsenal, but they're professionals and they know how to do them without killing their opponent. But I just got done watching this week's Cruiserweight Classic, okay? A great show. And there was a match between Johnny Gargano and TJ Perkins. And in that match, Johnny Gargano used a lawn dart. Now, I don't know if that's a move that he's known for in Evolve or whatever, but that's the first time that I've seen him use it. And that move looked far more dangerous than any buckle bomb I've ever seen Seth Rollins use. At least as dangerous, if not more dangerous. He literally ran and launched TJ Perkins headfirst, like a lawn dart, into the second turnbuckle. Now, if he takes that move wrong, if he bends, okay, his neck, I mean, he could be done for. Now, do I want to see the lawn dart bend? No, because I trust that when Johnny Gargano does it, he and the other guy know what the fuck they're doing, and everything is going to work out okay. And he also doesn't have to use it in every match. Like I said, that's the first time I've seen him use that move in WWE. But if you ban the buckle bomb, how the hell do you not ban the lawn dart? I mean, where does it end? Neville broke his ankle on a baseball slide. Should we ban baseball slides? Sami Zayn tore his shoulder, flailing his arms around wildly in the air. Should we take a page out of the NFL and ban all celebrations? You know, when they banned the curb stomp, I hated it. I went on the podcast and I said the exact same thing. Where does it end? To my knowledge, the only time Rollins ever hurt somebody with the move, he never injured anybody with the curb stomp. The only time he ever hurt someone with the curb stomp, I think, was Brock Lesnar got a lump on his head, because Brock Lesnar sold the shit out of that move. He looked great whenever Rollins would hit him with that move. You know, when Lesnar sold that, he went all in, you know? And so he got a little knot on his head. He got a little lump on his forehead. He wasn't injured. Nobody ever got injured taking that move. But they banned it anyway. I mean, I'll be honest. I was shocked they ever let him use it in the first place, especially with that name. I mean, that doesn't exactly have the greatest connotation, the whole curb stomp thing. I think curb stomp, I immediately think of two things. I think of that scene in The Sopranos, and I think of American History X. It's a very violent move. So they banned it because they didn't want little kids curb stomping their friends and saying they saw it on WWE television. So you know what? I can understand that. I still don't agree with it, but I can understand why they would want to do that. But where does it end? You know, WWE banned the pile driver many years ago. I can remember only one time hearing about somebody getting injured in WWE with a pile driver. It was the night that Undertaker debuted as the American Badass. He interfered in that Iron Man match. And time was running out, and they were kind of rushing there, and I'm sure that had something to do with it. And he picked up Triple H. And I guess, you know, he gave him a tombstone, and I guess he connected a little too much on that tombstone. It wasn't a major injury. Triple H didn't miss any time or anything like that. But that's the only time I can ever remember hearing or reading about the pile driver, somebody legitimately getting hurt in WWE on a pile driver. And the pile driver is an inherently dangerous maneuver. I mean, you're dropping somebody head first. But if you execute the move correctly, if you know what you're doing, it's as safe as a fucking clothesline. Jerry Lawler made a career out of pile-driving people, and he never hurt anybody with it. Andy Kaufman would tell you, well, I got hurt. You know, he was in a neck brace and everything, but he wasn't hurt. You know, it's like, but they banned the pile-driver. I hate this idea of banning moves. You can ask Rollins not to do, or tell him not to do it outside the ring. You can ask him to not even use it in every single match. Make it special, save it for big matches, but I wouldn't ban it. But, you know, like Sting, to this day, and I will never understand this, I will never understand why Sting, at 56 years of age, had to take not one, but two buckle bombs in a single match. How many times do we see Seth Rollins dish out multiple buckle bombs to somebody in a match? I mean, I'm sure he does it, but not very often. But to Sting, of all people, they saw the need to do two buckle bombs in one match. And Sting, hey, you know, Sting had his working shoes on that night. He was in there. He did a dive off the top rope at one point to the floor, which was nuts. And it's not even like he had a whole group of guys out there to catch him. He had one. And thank God it wasn't The Miz, or Sting would have splattered all over the floor. But I refuse to believe that it was Sting's idea to take two buckle bombs in that match. One buckle bomb, you know, one buckle bomb with a 56-year-old guy who's not used to taking them is tempting fate, okay? And he got hurt on that first one. To go ahead and take a second one is just, it's bad judgment. It's just bad judgment on everyone's part. It's bad judgment on Sting's part, because he could have said no. it's bad judgment on Rollins' part for even doing it in the first place. That's what that is. That's just poor judgment. But as far as banning the move, no, I'm not in favor of banning the move. Rollins is a pro. He would not have gotten this far if he had a rep for hurting people. And he has hurt a few people now. So again, you see that and it's like, okay, you know, let's talk to the guy and see what's going on here. But this idea that he's reckless and dangerous and all of this, again, he's been doing this for a long time. He went through all those years in developmental. If he was a danger to other people, if he was like fucking Ahmed Johnson back in the day where you had people complaining about this guy's not just injury prone for himself, he's hurting other people. Mr. Kennedy, there were a ton of top guys who complained about working with him because they thought he was safe or unsafe, I should say, or reckless. Supposedly John Cena, Shawn Michaels, Randy Orton obviously blew up on the guy. And guess what? He was gone. He got shit canned. He hasn't been back since. It's not like Rollins has this rep as being that kind of worker. So I think he's a pro. He just needs to be smarter when he does these things. And you don't have to get into the whole business of banning moves. There was a report this week that The Rock and Vin Diesel may be playing everybody in preparation for a match at WrestleMania. There's been some back and forth, some heat between the two of them. The Rock made a comment a few weeks ago about, you know, all the female actors on set of the Fast 8 movie being total professionals, and unfortunately he can't say the same for some of his male co-stars, and it came out that he was referring to Vin Diesel, and Vin Diesel's, you know, shots of videos on his Instagram or something. I don't know. There's something going on here. And the belief is that they're working to build to a match at WrestleMania next year in Orlando because the next Fast movie comes out like 2 weeks after WrestleMania. So this would be a way to promote the movie. And I'm sure in the end they would shake hands and everything would be okay. I'm not going to sit here and say they shouldn't do the match because I'm sure that match would be big box office. I think people would be willing to pay to see that match and it would get them a shit ton of publicity. And maybe that's the way they get The Rock on the WrestleMania card next year. So if they can pull it off, more power to them. But if they do that, then we don't need to see Big Show against Shaq. Because that was the other rumor, that they're building to a Big Show Shaquille O'Neal match that might be the Big Show's retirement match. I don't need to see Big Show, Shaq, and Rock against Vin Diesel at WrestleMania next year. I think that's a little too much. And of the two matches, I think Rock and Vin Diesel would probably make them more money. So if anything, I'd go with that. And all of this is just rumor. I mean, none of these matches are confirmed. But I don't need to see both of those matches on the WrestleMania card next year. That's just unnecessary. Holy foley. Let me talk a little bit about this before we get to Raw and SmackDown. I did watch the first two episodes. They have the first five up on demand right now on the WWE Network. It's the new Foley family reality show starring Mick Foley. Really, it's a vehicle to get his daughter over. More than anything, Mick's already over. He doesn't need a reality show to get himself more popular. It's very similar to Hogan Knows Best. This whole thing is very similar to Hogan Knows Best. Hogan Knows Best was clearly designed to help get Hulk's daughter over. And he was backing her music career and it fizzled out and it didn't work out very well. And in fact, that reality show tore that whole fucking family apart. So I really hope that, you know, Foley knows what he's doing here. And he seems like a pretty grounded family guy. I don't think the same thing will happen here, but, you know, you look at stuff like Hogan Knows Best and the Osbournes and, you know, things didn't turn out very well for either one of those families. So I hope Mick can avoid that and that he knows what he's doing here. I watched the show. Here's the thing. I wanted to give the show a chance because I like Mick Foley and I think it's really great that he's, you know, this big family man and all that. And I thought maybe it could be entertaining and it is entertaining on some level. I personally I am not a fan of reality shows like this. I'm so offended by the fact that they would even use the word reality because there's nothing real. There's hardly anything real about these shows. It's the reason why I don't watch Total Divas and I don't watch the Kardashians or I never watched the Osbournes. Hogan Knows Best, I watched a little bit, but then I gave up on that too. Because what they do with these shows is, and it's very obvious what they do, you know, they'll take some real-life situations, they may take some things that are real, but then, you know, everything else is all scripted and they have to build stories around it. Because basically, reality shows like this, and there I see, now I'm using the word, this is the modern-day version of what the television sitcom used to be in the 80s. And I grew up on those sitcoms. I grew up on Perfect Strangers and Family Ties and Family Matters and Full House and Just the Ten of Us and Step by Step and all those kinds of shows. Okay, that's what I grew up on. That's what I watched. TGIF every Friday night on ABC was must-watch TV. Okay, so I love, even to this day, I love watching shows like that when I see them in reruns. But those were, you know, scripted shows with people playing characters for half an hour every week and different stories and different situations every week. And that's what it was. Now, today, it's reality TV, where we can take real people in sometimes real situations and just script the fuck out of it, you know, because I'm sure a lot of these families aren't nearly as interesting in real life as they're portrayed to be on TV. And so if you literally just took a camera and you put it, you know, in their houses and you just follow them around all day, you're not going to get a lot of very interesting stuff. So we have to manufacture things. So I'm watching the first episode. I think it was the first one or the second one, maybe. Second episode. It was episode 2 of Holy Foley. And, you know, one of Mick's sons, Dewey, his older son, has gotten a job. Now, if you remember, you may have heard a while back that one of Mick's sons got a job as a writing assistant in WWE. That is real. As far as I know, he's still working for them as a writer's assistant. So on the show, they cover this. He got this job with WWE. The focus is all on his sister, though. He can't even get a word out to tell his family. They're not interested in hearing his big news. It's all about Noelle. Noelle reveals, I want to become a wrestler. And again, that may well be true. Noelle may well be training to become a wrestler right now. But the way everything is portrayed on the show is so obviously phony. Episode 2. It's Dewey's first day on the job. He goes to Titan Tower. He walks into the office and there's a woman who's going to have him sign some paperwork, and he said, his last name Foley. She goes, oh, wait, are you Mick Foley's son? And the story of the episode is that, oh, well, I'm my father's son, and I want to be my own man. I want to fly on my own. And everybody is just, oh, my God, it's Mick Foley's son. And at that exact moment, some idiot comes up from one of his cubicles. Are you Mick Foley's son? I'm Mick Foley's biggest fan, and I happen to have an action figure of his here. It's like, ugh, I wanted to vomit. It's just a personal thing with me. I just can't stand shows like that. I just can't, you know? And I think what Holy Foley is missing, and I will say this for Hogan Knows Best. On Hogan Knows Best, his friends would appear on the show a lot. Now, obviously, he's friends or was friends with Brian Knobbs. And Brian Knobbs is a fucking madman, okay? Brian Knobbs was made for reality TV. He was made for shows like this. And the funniest moment I ever saw on Hogan Knows Best, I think him and his wife were in their bedroom. They were going to bed. And I think Knobbs was staying over with them. And Knobbs knocks on the door and comes into their, like, pokes his head into their bedroom. And I think he had, like, a VHS maybe in his hand. He goes, hey, Hulk, you want to go watch WrestleMania 7? Because, you know, WrestleMania 7 was this great show. The Nasty Boys won the tag team belts and Hogan won the WWF title. Hey, let's go watch WrestleMania 7. Hogan's like, leave me alone. I laughed. I laughed so hard at that. I think Holy Foley is missing something like that. They need, like, the crazy friend or the crazy wrestler or something on the show. And Mick's just a nice guy. You know, Mick Foley, Cactus Jack, he was a madman in the ring. But here, it's just Mick Foley, the family man. He's very laid back. He's just a nice guy. He dresses up as Santa Claus. And that's all well and good. But I think it could really benefit from having something like a Brian Knobbs on the show, which at least the first two episodes I saw, it doesn't have. If you are into seeing Noelle Foley's journey to become a pro wrestler, and Noelle Foley is a very beautiful girl, you'll enjoy the show. I don't know that it's for me. So I might watch the third episode and see where it goes. I've only watched two so far. But, I myself am more of a fan of seeing stuff on the network like those 24 specials, Table for Three. Like, that's my kind of stuff. I want to see more of that kind of stuff on the network. Stuff like this, you know, it's nice to have, I guess. Everyone's doing the reality TV thing and all that, but it's not reality, folks. Come up with any word for it you want to. It ain't reality. There may be elements of reality in it, but there is nothing real about shows like this. Monday Night Raw was live from Brooklyn, New York, back at the Barclays Center for the third and final night. By this point, I think pretty much everybody in the building was tired. We had seen two nights of wrestling, including one very, very long night of wrestling with SummerSlam. And now we had another 3 hours, or 3.5 hours, if you count the Superstars taping beforehand and the dark match we got after. It was almost 4 hours of additional wrestling. That's a lot of wrestling for one weekend. And also, remember when I mentioned on the podcast last month, I had mentioned that I was told that the sets for Raw and SmackDown were not finished yet. They were not finished in time to debut on those first post-draft shows. Well, we got a new one on SmackDown this week, which looks great. I actually think the new SmackDown set looks really cool. And I'm told we're getting one for Raw, too, and it's probably not the one that you saw this week. The one you saw this week was left over from SummerSlam. I don't believe that is the new Raw set. I don't believe that's the one. I believe there's a different one that they're going to be using for Raw. I don't know if we're getting it this Monday or not, but that's just something to be aware of, that that's coming soon. And that's good, too. It's good to have different sets. It's good to differentiate the two shows. I like that. The Raw Instapoll, almost 1,900 votes, 46% thumbs up, 54% thumbs down. I'm going to throw this number, this poll out, just because they had to rebook this show on the fly with the Finn Balor injury. They only learned a few hours before the show that they, you know, were going to have to take the title from him. I don't think it's fair to be too hard on them this week, because it can't be easy to have to throw your entire show away and rebook a three-hour show like that. So, and it's not even like it was that bad of a show. By no means was this a bad show. It wasn't the most exciting show. And again, a lot of us in the arena were just tired. They opened with Finn Balor, less than 24 hours removed from becoming the first ever Universal Champion, coming out and relinquishing the Universal title to Mick Foley and Stephanie McMahon. My theory was that Balor faked an injury to get out of having to hold that ugly-looking belt, but then I saw the surgery footage, so obviously he was hurt. So my new theory is that he intentionally pulled his shoulder out of his socket to get out of having to hold that ugly-looking belt. Yeah, the Universal title sucks. I don't like it. And just to show you that I'm not hating on everything, I do like some of the new belts they debuted on SmackDown. I'm going to talk about that later. But this whole red all over shit just doesn't work. Although the side plates they had for Balor did look pretty cool for the one day that it lasted. Rollins came out thinking that they would have to hand him the title. He was going to be the new champion, but Foley said they had other plans. They booked a series of matches throughout the night, with the winners advancing to a fatal four-way tomorrow night to crown a new Universal Champion. So they're not even waiting until the Clash of the Champions pay-per-view, which is still a month away. I mean, I guess they could still do that. They could have some kind of fuck finish and end up not crowning a new champion until the pay-per-view. They kind of did that back in 98. Remember when they had the singles match between Kane and Undertaker? And Austin was the referee. They were going to crown a new champion, and Austin just stunned them both, and then Vince fired him. So they ended up not crowning a new champion until the Survivor Series. So I would not say it's 100% we're even going to get a new champion on Monday. I think we probably will. But don't be shocked if they try to extend this out until the pay-per-view. Seth Rollins beat Sami Zayn in the first match to advance. I love Zayn selling the ankle. He teased that he hurt his ankle midway through this match, and everybody gasped. I gasped. I'm like, oh, shit. Like, no, this can't be happening. But he was, you know, clearly sell. If you watch and you pay attention, you can kind of tell. Like, I see WWE trying to blur the lines a lot more lately with what they're doing. Was this real or was this not real? And I think that's fine. I think I have no problem with trying to add some realism into the shows. But I, as somebody who has watched their show for so long, and I know when the doctor comes in or when they put the gloves on or when they throw the X up or when they do stuff like that, I can kind of tell. I think I'm pretty good at being able to tell when something's wrong and when something is just supposed to be wrong. So it didn't take me very long to realize, all right, he's just selling an injury here. Because if his ankle really was that fucked up, believe me, the doctor would already be in the ring. So he's selling the hell out of this ankle injury, and I just thought it was great. And it played into the match, and he tried, but in the end, Rollins hit the pedigree, he got the win. Rollins then cut a promo on all of us in Brooklyn. I'm not sure if this aired on TV or not, but he was very upset by our chants the night before during his match about that ugly belt. And in the end, he vowed to win the championship. I actually thought it was a pretty good promo, so I hope everybody got to see it. Kevin Owens beat Neville to also advance to the championship match this Monday. Chris Jericho provided the distraction outside, and Owens won with a torture rack into a spinning neck breaker. Titus O'Neil came out for his Botchamania audition. Holy shit, if this doesn't win the award for worst promo of 2016, I would like to see what does. He may well have botched every single line of this promo, and I don't think I've ever seen that before. And I'm not even really exaggerating that much. If he didn't legitimately botch every line, he came pretty close. It was uncomfortable in the arena during this segment, because people knew this guy was drowning. They just knew he was drowning. I saw people with their head in their hands. At one point, Titus almost knocked the microphone out of his own hand. It was as though his body was involuntarily trying to get him to shut up. But yet he kept on going, and WWE did nothing to save him. They were probably laughing in the back. They let this guy drown. At one point, he said, "Come on out here, Darren Young," and nobody came out. And they stalled forever to the point where he had to talk more. Finally, Bob Backlund ran down to the ring. He put Titus in the chicken wing, which got a big pop in the arena. I hope it came across on TV. The place went nuts when he put him in that chicken wing. Titus shook him off. He gave 67-year-old Bob Backlund a body slam. Darren Young finally, I don't know what he was doing back there, that Darren Young fought, maybe he was taking a shit or something, but Darren Young finally runs down. And, I mean, he ran down to the ring, and Titus wasn't backing down. He was standing there, so I'm like, all right, he's going to tackle Titus, he's going to take him down. Nope. He gets into the ring, he immediately stops, and he tends to Bob Backlund. He's cradling Bob Backlund's head in his arms like Backlund is dying, like Backlund was shot, and the life is being sucked out of his body. And Titus is just standing, and he's yelling at Titus, but he's not attacking Titus. So here's a guy who called him out, who just beat up his mentor, and all he could do is cradle the guy in his arms and yell at him. So Titus, of course, says, fuck this. He grabs the guy. He lays him out with the Clash of the Titus, which Darren Young absolutely deserved. This sucked. This sucked. One of the worst segments on Raw all year. All it took was one bad promo by Matt Hardy for Vince McMahon to just give up on the guy and lose faith in him. So this was not a good night for Titus. And I think, you know, it's those scripted promos. You could see him trying. I went back and I watched this so many times. You could see him trying to remember all of his lines. And this is what happens. This is what happens when you have somebody who isn't good at remembering scripted lines. I've heard Titus do public speaking. He's actually pretty good. He's got that great booming voice. But man, this was painful to watch. This was painful to watch. Stephanie McMahon said there would be repercussions for Brock Lesnar assaulting her brother at SummerSlam. He had given Shane McMahon an F5. And later on, his punishment was announced on WWE.com. They said Brock Lesnar would be fined. Are you ready for this? Brock Lesnar would be fined $500 for his actions at SummerSlam. In the immortal words of George W. Bush, how will Brock be able to put food on his family? How's he going to be able to do it? Lesnar made more than that in the time it took me to make that bad joke. Stephanie clearly showing no regard for her brother. That's the storyline. This should make Vince McMahon very happy, because if you remember, Vince went on TV and said, I want to see the two of you slit each other's throats and break the law, so long as you don't get caught. They haven't broken the law yet. But Stephanie clearly has no regard for her brother. We had Rusev. Busted ribs and all, against Big Cass, in another qualifying match. In the arena, when Lana asked everybody to rise for Rusev, almost everybody stood up. I thought that was funny. I stood for Rusev. Rusev Machka. Unfortunately, Rusev Machka doesn't seem to give a flying fucka about the Universal title, since he ended up walking out in the middle of this match and getting himself counted out. See, so even Rusev was all like, oh, the hell with that ugly belt, mine is better. So how about that? Big Cass earns a spot in the four-way title match. He, as far as I'm concerned, he's just a body. He's one of those new era bodies to have in there. He ain't winning this match. I know he's big and all, but it would be an unbelievably huge mistake to put the title on him right now. He's popular, and he may get to that point at some point where he could be a champion, but to do it now, it's like all those guys they would call up early from developmental when they clearly weren't ready, and they fucked them all up. You know, they called up Chris Masters and just all these different people. You gotta, I understand striking when the iron is hot. The iron ain't that hot for Big Cass to be the champion. So to put the title on him now would be a huge mistake. And you're not doing him any favors either. He is nowhere near ready for that spot. And I think they know that. I hope they do. The new women's champion, Charlotte, was out gloating with Dana Brooke over her title win. Sasha Banks has an injured back. Thankfully, she doesn't need surgery, so it'll be a month or two before we see her again. So to fill the void, Mick Foley came out to announce that they have drafted the hottest free agent of the new era. So you can imagine my disappointment when Kota Ibushi didn't walk out. Instead, we got Bayley, and all I can say is it's about damn time. Long overdue. Now, I expected her to end up on SmackDown, but I guess, you know, Sasha got hurt. I assume that changed everything. We even got the wacky wailing inflatable tube men when she came out, which made me very happy. She got Chance of You Deserve It. People very happy to see Bayley out there. She challenged Charlotte to a championship match. Instead, she got a match with Dana Brooke, which hardly feels like a good trade-off. She won with the belly-to-Bayley suplex. I assume it's going to be Charlotte and Bayley for the title at the Clash of the Champions show. And I think it would be a big mistake to put the title on Bayley this early. I like Bayley. I'm a Bayley fan. I would not put the championship on her. Bayley, here's the thing with Bayley. I do believe that you have a good part of the WWE audience that watches NXT, that knows who Bayley is. But there's also a very good part of that audience that doesn't. And Bayley works best as an underdog. So for years in NXT, Bayley would lose. She would have an opportunity. She would fall just short. And everybody was passing her by. Charlotte was winning titles and Sasha was winning titles. Actually, everybody ended up winning titles except Becky Lynch. But she was always the underdog. You know, the reason her match with Sasha Banks worked so well at that TakeOver show last year was because she lost so many times before she finally started to win. You've got to do that again on the main roster. Bayley should not win the title until WrestleMania. At the earliest, she should not win the championship until WrestleMania. Any earlier than that is a mistake. The Cruiserweights are coming to Raw September 19th, the Monday after the Cruiserweight Classic ends. They are awarding a giant cup. They had the... what's that show? Choppers, American Chopper or something. There's like a reality show with a father and a son. They make motorcycles. Something Chopper. I don't know what the fuck the show is called. But it was funny seeing them at SummerSlam. They unveiled this. And I have a friend who watches that show. He was actually with me. Might have been at the NXT show because he wasn't at SummerSlam. But he was like, oh, look who it is. It's that guy from, American Chopper or Onion Chopper or whatever the hell it's called. And he's like, he's not a wrestling fan. What's he doing here? So apparently the guy really isn't a wrestling fan. But they went to these guys to have them make the trophy that they will award to the Cruiserweight Classic winner. And that means that as far as crowning the first Cruiserweight champion, I guess they're going to have a tournament on Raw to crown one. That would be my guess. You would think the winner of the tournament should get the championship, but I guess unless that trophy is the championship. But I guess they'll have a tournament for the new belt. Braun Strowman killed another jobber on this show. Crowd actually started a Let's Go Jobber chant in the section next to us during this match. But before the match, Byron Saxton got into the ring to interview Strowman's opponent. And thankfully, those of us in the arena could not hear this interview. I had to listen to it when I got home. When I watched it back, the interview consisted of Byron Saxton asking young Johnny Knockout why he would want to step in the ring against Braun Strowman. And his response was, and I quote, "Because I like big, sweaty men." Remember last week when I mentioned Braun Strowman, the homosexual destroyer, when talking about ideas that I could see WWE coming up with for their outreach to the LGBT community? I wasn't too far off. We're off to a rip-roaring start to that effort now, aren't we? Yeah, this'll end well. The Dudley Boys gave a farewell speech on this show. The swerve was that it actually turned out to be their legitimate farewell. I and everybody else in the arena thought for sure that Bubba Ray was turning on D-Von. And apparently that had been the plan. The Dudleys had signed a one-year deal last year. They made their big comeback in that very building in Brooklyn in the Barclays Center. They had verbally agreed to a new deal a few weeks ago. They started that angle. I mean, it was clear they were going in a direction with these guys because there was a miscommunication in every match, and Bubba would clothesline Devon, and they kept losing. So clearly this was going somewhere. And as best as I can gather, the plan was for Bubba to get a singles run as a heel, which was long overdue. I was calling for that from, I mean, years ago. That I would love to see Bully Ray get a shot on the WWE roster. And then I guess maybe a week or so ago, plans changed, and WWE decided not to live up to their verbal agreement, and they elected not to re-sign them. I don't know what happened, but this was their goodbye. This was the send-off for the Dudley Boys. They gave them, I thought, a very respectful send-off, all things considered, better than most people get. I mean, they gave a very heartfelt speech. They basically turned themselves baby faces on their way out. They mentioned their TLC matches with Edge and Christian and the Hardys, which got loud chants of delete, delete, delete from the crowd, which was pretty cool to hear. I never thought I would see the day that Matt Hardy was more popular than Jeff Hardy, but here we are. The Shining Stars came out to groans. They offered to send the Dudley Boys to Puerto Rico. The Dudleys gave Epico a 3D. They were setting up a table to put Primo through when Anderson and Gallows ran out from the crowd. They attacked the Dudleys. They laid out Bubba with a Magic Killer on the floor. They put Devon through a table with the Magic Killer. And so in one segment, they turned babyface, they hit their finish on someone, and they put over the heel team on their way out. And Anderson and Gallows really needed it, too. I mean, these guys have been just treated like shit lately. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, it's nice that they got to show some of their funny personality with those doctor skits and everything and the balls in a jar and all that. But this is bullshit. I mean, this is not what I envisioned when these guys first came in. And things were going well. You know, they hooked them up with AJ Styles. They were pretty prominently featured. It was going pretty good. And then WWE got their grubby paws on them, and now it's like, and even on this show, they had Big E against Anderson. So, of course, what happens? Anderson lost. Big E beat him 1-2-3. Now, I do hope the end result of all this at the next pay-per-view is they finally get those belts. But these guys, I think, have been just handled like shit lately. And they needed something like this. They needed to get heat on these guys somehow. Again, the problem is, when they lose and lose, you wonder why a lot of these guys don't feel special. And at least here, they tried to make them special, and it seemed to work. Now, as far as the Dudleys leaving, I think it's very disappointing for this reason. I didn't think there was anything left for Devon. So my thought was, okay, they're going to split them up. Bubba's going to go heel. Devon's leaving. Because what do you do with Devon? You know, I mean, you could just keep him around, I guess, as a guy on the roster to put people over. But other than that, there ain't nothing left for Devon. But for Bubba, I mean, I was a big fan of Bully Ray TNA on the microphone. I mean, the matches, look, I mean, you know, the matches were what they were. I'm not saying he's having these great 4-star matches, but as a character, I really dug Bully Ray. And if WWE just let him off the leash a little bit, you could have had a really like solid upper mid-card heel on that Raw roster. And the fact that they never gave him a shot, he came back in the tie-dye with the glasses and the tape in the middle. Just, you know, it was a total nostalgia act. And they never gave this guy a chance to just branch out and show what he can do as a heel, as a singles star. To me, it was a complete waste. I really think they dropped the ball. They dropped the ball. They could have done something with him. And I don't know who made that call or why they changed their minds. But maybe it was a money issue. I don't know. But I really think there was a lot of wasted potential there with Bubba not getting that singles run. So, as far as where they go from here, I guess they can pretty much go anywhere. I mean, they can go back to TNA, they can go to Japan, Ring of Honor. I mean, if I'm a independent promotion, I think it's kind of crazy to not at least inquire and make an offer to them. The Dudley Boys still have, there's still name value there. I still think you could do stuff with them. So I'm sure they'll land somewhere. I wouldn't be shocked if they actually went back to TNA. TNA's been on something of a signing spree lately. So I would not be shocked if they end up going back there. Roman Reigns beat Chris Jericho in the final qualifying match for the Fatal 4-Way this Monday. Roman Reigns in the building was despised, as you would imagine. Kevin Owens came out to help Jericho, but it wasn't enough. Reigns hit a spear on Jericho, got the pin. Big pop for the spear. So this fickle crowd that booed Roman Reigns the whole time cheered the hell out of that spear, and then they booed him afterwards. So, I don't know what these people want. I don't think they know what they want. After the show, we got a tag team dark match. John Cena and Dean Ambrose against AJ Styles and Seth Rollins. I believe the SmackDown house shows on Monday nights start this week, so we will not be getting any more of these mixing of the brands, at least I hope not. Ambrose pinned Rollins, by the way. Dirty deeds to send the crowd, the very tired crowd, home happy. If we didn't sound overly loud, it's just, like I said, three straight nights of wrestling will do that to you. So, this Monday, it's Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, and Big Cass to crown a new WWE Universal Champion. According to the latest Observer newsletter, the plan had been for Rollins, much like Roman Reigns, to take a back seat for a little while, and for Balor to defend the championship against Kevin Owens at the first Raw brand pay-per-view, then do a three-way in October with Jericho. And that makes me sad, because I think those would have been some great matches. But it does give me hope that Kevin Owens might just have a shot here. In fact, he's the one I want to see win that four-way match, and he's the one I'm picking to win. Kevin Owens is my prediction for this match. Just because Balor got hurt doesn't make this any less of a new era, right? They love to use that phrase, the new era. Rollins doesn't scream new era to me anymore. Not when he's been around for, what, 4 years now? And he already held the championship for almost a year. Reigns doesn't scream new era. Big Cass does scream new era, but he's nowhere near ready for that spot. Kevin Owens is ready for that spot. He's been ready. Question is, if he wins, who then challenges him for the championship at the next pay-per-view? And to me, the most obvious answer would be Sami Zayn. The people love Sami Zayn. He's had the feud with Owens going for a while now. He beat Owens at Battleground in their last match. I know that was supposed to be the final match for now, but you know what? Shit happens. Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn for the Universal title would be a fine main event for that Clash of Champions show. And you could still do a three-way then with Jericho at the October pay-per-view. Now, where that would leave Seth Rollins, I'm not sure. You know, Cesaro is in the middle of a best-of-seven series with Sheamus, with the winner of that getting a title shot. At least that's my understanding. There's no other babyface for him to feud with. I mean, they're in a real pickle right now. I mean, realistically, Brock Lesnar should be champion because nobody can beat the guy. But he ain't around. You know, Balor's hurt. Reigns is still feuding with Rusev. They split these brands, and all it takes is one or two guys to go down, and it just screws everything up. But, you know, to me, it's such a simple thing as far as what you do here. Reigns could have the match won. He's got the title won when Rusev runs down to ruin it for him, which puts more heat on their feud. And you shock the world by putting the championship on Kevin Owens. I mean, Kevin Owens is as good a choice as anybody right now. He's popular, he has great matches, and he can talk. There's absolutely no reason not to give him a shot. SmackDown Live. I realized something watching this show. SmackDown, and I'm sure the two-hour format has a lot to do with this, but it's not the only reason. SmackDown is just such an easier show to watch than Raw. And it's been pretty enjoyable, too. They're really making the most of the talent they have right now, and chief among them is AJ Styles. The match he had with John Cena at SummerSlam was just outstanding. Every big match with Styles this year has been outstanding. Going all the way back to his match with Nakamura at Wrestle Kingdom in another promotion. Okay, this guy is the best in the world. And at SummerSlam, the company put their stamp of approval on him. They gave him a clean win over their biggest star. That is, to me, one hell of an endorsement right there. Even the opening segment on this show backstage, you know, you have AJ, he's wearing John Cena's armband around his head and mocking Dolph Ziggler. Dolph is just sitting in the back sulking because he's a loser. He certainly was at SummerSlam, and he's got every reason to sulk, and he's just mocking Dolph. I just thought that whole segment and AJ in that segment was tremendous. And even the match he had later in the show with Ziggler, you know, to determine a new number one contender for the WWE Championship was really good stuff. The right guy won, and now it's going to be AJ Styles against Dean Ambrose for the championship at Backlash. His third pay-per-view main event, wrestling for the WWE Championship this year for AJ Styles. He didn't win it those first two times. I think he needs to win it now. The time has come. He just beat John Cena. He is the best performer in the entire company. He has arguably been their MVP. He is the real star of that SmackDown brand. All due respect to Dean Ambrose. I don't dislike Dean Ambrose, but his run as champion has been a real disappointment. I liked a lot of the stuff that they did with him and Ziggler building to their match at SummerSlam, but their match at SummerSlam was just a massive letdown. Maybe they do a DQ or some kind of a schmoz finish at the pay-per-view. They build to a rematch and Styles wins the title there, but the end result of this program needs to be AJ Styles, new WWE champion, because any other result is just a crime. Now, of course, if that happens, you know that when John Cena comes back, he's getting his win back. But we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I can't worry about that right now. I think he'll be gone for a few months. We have new titles on SmackDown. We have a new women's championship that looks just like the women's title on Raw. Except this one has a blue backing for the center plate. I think it's kind of ugly. The SmackDown tag team belts, though, I actually really like these a lot. They're the same design as the Raw belts, but instead of looking like giant pennies, these actually look like giant dimes. But they have a blue strap, and I don't know what it is, but the blue strap and the silver, I think, really go together nicely. I think they look great. I'm actually a big fan of these SmackDown tag team belts. Now, at Backlash, they're going to be having a six-pack challenge with Becky Lynch, Nikki Bella, Natalya, Naomi, Carmella, and Alexa Bliss to crown a new first ever SmackDown Women's Champion. And they're also going to have the finals of a tag team tournament that's already started to determine a new SmackDown Tag Team Champions. The Usos beat The Ascension on this show. American Alpha beat Fabreeze to each advance in the tournament. Heath Slater, he wanted in this tournament. Shane McMahon and Daniel Bryan told him, well, if you could find a partner, you're in, but you have to win the tournament if you want to win a WWE contract. So Slater has gotten himself over with this angle. I think this is the best thing that's happened to this guy in a long time. Even at Raw, people were chanting for Slater. I can't remember the last time they did that. It's almost as though, what it reminds me of is Zack Ryder in 2011. I remember being in Madison Square Garden in 2011, and they left Zack Ryder off the show. And this was at his peak of popularity. This was right before they put the U.S. title on him. And they left him off the show. And people were pissed. And he had a run-in. He ran in after the U.S. title match with Ziggler and John Morrison, and he got a big reaction, and people chanted Ziggler throughout the whole night. In fact, one of the Survivor Series elimination matches that night, Sin Cara got hurt. Surprise, surprise. And people knew that he was hurt, and he had to be taken out, and people were chanting for Ryder because they wanted him to come out and take his spot. And when the show was over, so this was the show where The Rock wrestled his first match in like 8 years, and he teamed with John Cena against The Miz and R-Truth. Remember The Miz and R-Truth headlining a pay-per-view against The Rock and John Cena. So the show goes off the air, The Rock is out there, he's on the mic, he's cutting a promo for us, and the Ryder chants, the We Want Ryder chants were such that The Rock had to stop. He had to interrupt his own promo to put Zack Ryder over and say, oh, I saw that kid in the back, he's a lot taller than I thought he was. Oh, he's great, he's a great talent. I mean, Zack Ryder was just, the people just loved him. They wanted this guy on TV. And I'm not saying that Heath Slater is at that exact level of popularity that Ryder was, because he's not, but he's kind of getting there. That's kind of what it reminds me of a little bit. And you know, credit to him and credit to WWE for it. This is a WWE angle. You know, they left him out of the draft. Remember the end of the draft on the network? He was the only one sitting in the room. They turned the lights out on him. It's like, oh, they're making this guy into a joke. But no, I mean, they're actually giving him something to do, and they're making people almost sympathize with the fact that this guy's got a family, he's got kids, he needs a contract, and they want to see him do well. So, which leads me to the potential outcomes here of this tag team tournament. So, you know, Rhino has agreed to be Heath Slater's partner. So Rhino and Slater are in the tournament, okay? They could very well win the entire thing. You could have Jordan and Gable win the belts, but I almost think it would be too predictable to just put the belts on them right now. It might be a little too soon for that. They should probably make people want to see it more. The Usos. Okay, the Usos have been dropping hints of a heel turn, so I can see them either turning in this tournament and winning the belts and having Jordan and Gable chase them for the titles, or, you know, the two teams meet. Let's say Jordan and Gable win, then the Usos turn, And then in the finals, maybe they cost American Alpha the match. And that is what leads to Rhino and Heath Slater winning the tag team belts. Either way, I think the Usos come out of this as the bad guys, feuding with Jordan and Gable, either with or without the titles. There's one spot open in this tournament, and it is apparently going to be filled by, of all people, the Headbangers. Mosh and Thrasher, talk about a blast from the past. They both went on their Facebook pages. They claimed that they're going to be on SmackDown this Tuesday. I certainly hope for their sake they didn't spill the beans when WWE didn't want that leaked, because if so, that could be very bad for them. So unless WWE gets pissed and changes their plans, it looks like it's going to be the Headbangers against Rhino and Heath Slater this Tuesday. It's a new era, everyone. Rhino and the Headbangers. It's a new era. Speaking of heel turns, they turned Carmella on this show. She was supposed to wrestle Nikki Bella, but she attacked Nikki from behind while she was being interviewed, left her laying. She attacked Nikki again later on during the Talking Smack post-show backstage. I like it. I think this is the best thing that could happen to Carmella. Her act was getting kind of stale, especially without Kaz and Enzo, you know, to play off of. I think she was coming out to crickets on most weeks. I thought Alexa Bliss turning heel was the best thing for her when she was in NXT, and I think it'll be good for Carmella. They already have Becky, and now Nikki is the top babyfaces, and Naomi is back. You know, when Eva Marie comes back, she'll probably be the top heel. So all of a sudden, the women's division is looking pretty okay right now on SmackDown. I still think they could use one more person, but they've got a few different stories going with the women at the moment, you know, so I'm digging it. Suddenly, the SmackDown Women's Division looks stronger than Raw's. Because I was having a conversation with Noah. We were at the Raw the other night, and I was saying to him, man, who are the people in the Women's Division on Raw? Like, okay, we have Charlotte and Dana. Sasha's hurt, so she's gone. Bayley just debuted, and you have Nia Jax. And I couldn't think of anyone else. I had to rack my brain before I finally realized, oh, yeah, they have Summer Rae, and oh, yeah, they have Alicia Fox. And that's it. And we haven't even seen Summer or Alicia on TV. So, you know, this wasn't the case a few weeks ago, but all of a sudden the SmackDown Women's Division is looking stronger than Raw's. Randy Orton was on the show, 10 staples in his head. He said that he and Brock Lesnar would cross paths again. I don't know why you would want to. If he did that to me, I would stay as far away from this guy as possible. Bray Wyatt popped up in a rocking chair in the aisle, and he cut a promo on Randy Orton, so there's your next feud. Shane McMahon was interviewed backstage about his sister fining Lesnar a whopping $500 for attacking him. He said the issue with himself and Brock was not over. So, does that mean that we're getting Brock Lesnar against Shane McMahon? 'Cause it sure sounded like that to me. Is Orton saying that he's not done with Lesnar? I mean, is he going to get a rematch? I mean, between Orton saying that and Shane saying that, the only question I have is, why the hell did you draft Brock Lesnar to Raw? You've got two people on SmackDown who are primed for potential matches with him, and Brock is a Raw guy. I don't think they thought this through. So, in the head-to-head matchup this week, Raw versus SmackDown, I thought SmackDown won the week easily. But let's talk about Talking Smack. Okay, this is quickly becoming a must-see show on the network every week. This week, they interviewed the Usos. And Daniel Bryan asked them at one point blank, "You guys sometimes get booed now when you come out. Why do you think that is?" And Jimmy Uso just flat out said, "Well, it started around the time we started associating ourselves with Roman Reigns." No shit! You don't say. I mentioned Carmella already. She attacked Nikki Bella on the set, knocked her over the desk. We had The Miz. The Miz interrupted the show. He was very upset. He felt disrespected by all this talk of all the new titles on SmackDown. He has been the Intercontinental Champion now for something like 140 days. If you recall, I had the chance to interview Miz last week. I played the audio on Sound Off 457. I asked him a question about the Intercontinental title not having the kind of prestige in the eyes of the fans that it used to have, and that sort of set him off a little bit. I mean, he launched into work mode, but that kind of set him off, and I would like to think that I lit a fire under this guy's ass, so I will gladly take credit for this meltdown that he had here. this was the best promo of his entire career. And he has been there for 10 years now, so that's saying a lot. This was easily the most fire and passion that I have seen in a Miz promo in all of those 10 years. To the point where, by the end, when he looked directly into the camera, I was so happy that he did that. When he looked into the camera, his eyes were almost bloodshot. Okay, they were so red. And what set him off was Daniel Bryan talking about how he didn't like the way that The Miz wrestled. He was not a fan of how The Miz wrestled. He said he wrestles like a coward. He said when he was still an independent wrestler, Bryan would think of the so-called WWE soft style, and he would immediately think of The Miz. The Miz was kind of the face of that soft style. And Miz took great offense to this, and he defended himself. He said that he's never once in his entire career, not once, has he suffered an injury that has kept him out for 6 months to a year. That's why he wrestles the way he does, because the company knows they can rely on him to be there day in and day out. He called Bryan a coward for vowing to return in 1 year's time to get back the Intercontinental title, but Bryan never did. And Bryan said, hey, I would have come back if WWE would let me. And Miz said, well, why don't you just quit if you love this so much? And that way you can go wrestle in bingo halls with all of your indie friends. Which is ironic because that's what Daniel Bryan supposedly tried to do, but WWE wouldn't let him out of his contract. So this hit very close to home. This was as good of a work shoot as you'll see. Bryan walked off the set at that point. Miz ranted on. He looked directly into the camera. He vowed to continue his Intercontinental title world tour. All I can say is, where the hell has this Miz been the entire time? This was great. I think I've turned a corner here on that SummerSlam finish. I may have changed my mind. I thought it was ridiculous to have him just beat Apollo Crews clean the way he did. But I want to see Apollo Crews try to cut a promo like this. I don't think he has it in him. But I can get behind this version of the Miz. I can. I don't think I could ever take him seriously as a world champion. But in this role, I think he would do just fine. And I say that because here's the thing with The Miz. As a top guy in WWE today, there are certain expectations that the fans have when it comes to your in-ring work. They have so many talented guys on that roster and waiting in the wings in developmental to come up to the main roster who could work circles around The Miz. Fact is, you got to be able to go in there and put on great matches. And the fact is, as great as this promo was and as great of a heel as The Miz can be, I don't think I have ever seen a single great Miz match in 10 years. Maybe the TLC match he had with Jerry Lawler that one time, maybe. But I can't think of a truly great... I remember a really good... Was it a street fight or a Falls Count Anywhere or something that he had on TV once with John Morrison? I don't know if I'd call that great, but I'd have to go back and watch it. But off the top of my head, I cannot remember seeing a single great Miz match. Like, I can come up with at least one or two if you ask me about almost anybody else on that roster who's been around for that long. Even Big Show, I'm sure I could find. I think, actually, the match that Big Show had with Roman Reigns, they had an Extreme Rules match once. I thought that was pretty great. But I can't think of a single great Miz match. And that, to me, is what separates him from the truly top guys in that company. But, you know, for the people asking, well, was this real? This was real, Solomon. Or was this a shoot? Any great work shoot has elements of reality to it. I don't doubt for a second that there were some very real feelings there that The Miz was letting. And maybe Bryan, too. Maybe Bryan actually did feel that way about The Miz. But I don't doubt for a second that Miz had a lot of this shit bottled up inside of him, and he was just, now that he had a chance to kind of get it out there on TV, he went all in. And it, you know, the end result was great. There was a lot of very real frustration, I'm sure, there with things that people have said about him. But this was designed for one purpose. This was designed, I don't even think it was designed to help get the Miz over or anything like that. It was designed to get people talking about talking smack. And guess what? It worked. This is all anybody's been talking about since Tuesday. And last I checked, the video on their YouTube channel had over 1.3 million views. They got exactly what they wanted. Believe me, Miz is not going on WWE television and shooting on Daniel Bryan. It's comical that anybody would even think that. Miz ain't shooting on anybody on their TV. Miz is the quintessential company robot. He's almost as bad as Cena. There's hardly any authenticity there. This promo may have been the most authentic sounding I've ever heard this guy, but he is the last person who would ever go on their show and go off script, okay? The last person. So no, I don't believe for a second that this was anything other than what it was designed to be. It was meant to create a buzz for their new show, and it worked. And now, if they can parlay that into maybe doing something with The Miz, all the better. Again, I don't see him as a top guy, world champion on the brand, or anything like that. But you could definitely take The Miz now. He's got some juice. And, you know, make him into something other than the joke, quite frankly, that he's been portrayed as for a long time, even just a few weeks ago. And I know Randy Orton is a bigger star than he is. And The Miz should not be beating Randy Orton, but they did that non-title match. And, you know, Orton just beat him. And I'm not a fan of just doing matches with champions and just beating them and beating them, because if you do that, they should lose the title. But The Miz has not been portrayed as anything that we should get overly excited about for so long, and now all of a sudden we kind of have a reason to, you know, almost get behind the guy. Because there was a lot of truth to what he said. So I hope they do more with him on SmackDown now. But this was meant to get Talking Smack over, and if you haven't watched Talking Smack, I've seen it the last couple of episodes. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. They basically just have Renee Young and Daniel Bryan sit there. And Daniel Bryan is kind of, you know, he's weaving storyline stuff in there. But he's basically sitting there giving his thoughts and opinions on things. And so are some of the other wrestlers they bring on. It does not feel scripted or, and by scripted I mean word for word. Like if this was planned, I don't think anybody handed Miz and Bryan a script and said, hey, this is what we want you to say. It doesn't come off like a promo in WWE. It doesn't come off like Titus O'Neil's promo on Raw, put it that way. They are a lot more loose with it, and I think it just makes for a really fun show. So you should check it out if you haven't already. NXT this week was... it just was a nothing show. You know, there were two matches they taped from the Barclays Center before TakeOver on Saturday that I saw. One was Ty Dillinger, who got a big pop coming out. But of course, you know, first guy out is going to get a big pop. He beat Wesley Blake. And the Authors of Pain, who have some pretty cool theme music, they beat TM61. And also, the Authors of Pain now have names. And I hope I'm pronouncing them right. I know one of them is Akam, and the other one is Rezar. And I can't be the only one who thinks Rezar and Toka from the Secret of the Ooze when I hear that. I hope I'm not. Other than that, it was just a bunch of highlights from TakeOver. There was one segment from backstage. Bayley was being interviewed. Ember Moon came up. I said this in my review when I reviewed TakeOver. The thing that struck me about Ember Moon, besides her awesome-looking finish, is how freaking tiny she is. And in this promo, she walks up to Bayley. She's so short. She is so short. She might be shorter than Alexa. I'm not sure who's the bigger girl, but... aside from having that little bit of interaction with Ember Moon and Bayley that I had not previously seen, there was just nothing on this show that you didn't already see. So they'll be back to normal next Wednesday. Now, the Cruiserweight Classic was really good. I really enjoyed this week's episode. This was round two with the quarterfinals starting next week. Rich Swann beat Lince Dorado with the Phoenix Splash. Really fun match. Zack Sabre Jr. beat Drew Gulak. He reversed a Dragon Sleeper into a cradle for the pin. This was a much more hard-hitting match than the one Zack Sabre had in the opening round. And you gotta see these palm strikes that these guys were throwing at the end. These weren't slaps, these were palm strikes. And they were just wrecking the shit out of each other. Just brutal stuff. So Zack Sabre advances, and in the main event they had TJ Perkins beating Johnny Gargano with the knee bar. And the crowd was stunned when TJ won. They thought for sure that Gargano was winning this match. This was interesting because this match was taped before TakeOver and before SummerSlam, like weeks before. And they clearly knew, they already had a long-term direction as far as what they were going to be doing in the Gargano-Ciampa revival match at TakeOver. Because if you remember in that match, they went after Gargano's knee, they kind of injured it, they tapped him out with a knee bar actually in that match, or a figure four, it was one or the other. And so here, even though this was taped weeks in advance, they interviewed Gargano backstage. His knee was all taped up. he was favoring the knee in the match. The announcers were you know, they spliced in more current commentary, so the announcers were talking about the injury from TakeOver. So I thought that was very interesting that he was selling an injury that he had not yet suffered. But it worked. It played into the story of the match, and TJ Perkins won, so he advances. So, the quarterfinals are set. It's going to be Akira Tozawa against Grand Metalik, Zack Sabre Jr. against Noam Dar, Brian Kendrick against Kota Ibushi, and Rich Swann against TJ Perkins. And I look at this, and again, I don't read spoilers or anything like that, but I look at this, and if I had to make predictions, if I had to make picks, I think, you know, Tozawa and Metalik is kind of a tough one to call, but I'm going to say Grand Metalik gets the win and advances. I'm going to say Zack Sabre Jr. advances over Noam Dar, who I've yet to see something out of. I'm still waiting for that great Noam Dar match. Brian Kendrick and Kota Ibushi. Ibushi's got to win. I mean, I know they're telling a story with Kendrick. That story needs to end, and Ibushi needs to advance, even if he doesn't win. And Ibushi was my pick, and from what I understand, he has not signed a contract with them. He does not yet want to sign a full-time deal. He may make appearances for them going forward, but he has not signed a deal. That makes me think he ain't winning. They're not going to have somebody win this tournament who's not signed to a contract. So my Kota Ibushi pick may be in jeopardy, but Rich Swann and TJ Perkins, that's the match to me that's the hardest to call. And I would say that if it ain't Kota Ibushi winning this whole thing, the person who wins this entire tournament is going to be the winner of that Rich Swann-TJ Perkins match. Whoever wins that match and moves on is probably going to be the guy that wins if it ain't Ibushi. And if I had a pick between Swann and TJ Perkins, who I think is going to advance. Now, I think they're advertising TJ Perkins in the commercials for the Cruiserweight division on Raw, so that tells me he's probably signed and he's sticking around. I got to go with Rich Swann. I mean, I know Swann is signed. He's an NXT guy, so I think both guys are probably under contract. I got to go with Rich Swann. He's my pick. I think he's going to advance, and I think if it's not Ibushi winning this entire thing because he's not signed, I guess Rich Swann is my pick. You know, Zack Sabre, it's the same thing. I think he's on record as saying he doesn't want to sign. He has other things he wants to accomplish. He wants to wrestle all over the world. And so, again, if he's not signed to a deal, I don't see them having somebody win this tournament if they're not locked under a WWE contract. So, I was at the Field of Honor show last night here in Brooklyn. It's been a while since I've been to a Ring of Honor show, and they had one here at MCU Park, which is the minor league baseball stadium. They've had shows here before. I'm terrible at these crowd estimates, but if I had to put a number on it, it looked like maybe anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 people in a stadium that fits 7,000 or more with standing room. So I don't know how that would compare to the last show ROH had here. But from what I saw, a good show. I couldn't stay for the entire thing, which was kind of a bummer. I mean, you had Hiroshi Tanahashi in the main event as part of a four-way for the ROH title. But I couldn't stick around for that. But the matches that I did see, there's actually a great match. I believe it was for the IWGP Intercontinental title between Michael Elgin defending against Donovan Dijak. There was a tag team gauntlet, so a series of matches. They had Ghetto teaming with Toriano, and they had the Briscoes were in there, and War Machine, and the All Night Express, the Addiction. So some really good stuff that I was able to watch, and all, you know, I was talking to someone with ROH, part of the ROH dojo, and they were bringing up the fact that, hey, how come you don't review Ring of Honor anymore? And it's a great point, because I was reviewing Ring of Honor for a while. I actually took that poll about a year ago, asking, what would you like for me to review? Would you prefer that I review TNA or Ring of Honor? And Ring of Honor pretty much ran away with the poll. I wonder how different that might be now, because I know people have said that the TNA product has improved and all of that, but I'm, you know, been there, done that. But Ring of Honor, it just kind of fell off only because there were so many shows and just not enough time, and it's not because I dislike the product. And actually, they pump out some pretty good stuff, so I'm going to make an effort. I can't say it'll be every week, but I do want to make an effort to get back to watching Ring of Honor, which I guess I'll have to do on their website because I don't have Comet TV here where I am, but watching it and maybe commenting on it a little bit more, because it kind of falls under the radar, I think, a lot more than it should. You know, people talk about NXT, and now they have the Cruiserweight Classic, and Lucha Underground is coming back in a couple of weeks. But Ring of Honor is pumping out some pretty good stuff, so I'm going to make an effort to have a little bit more ROH coverage on here. But again, from what I saw last night at the show, it was pretty good stuff. Let's take your mailbag questions. I guess we'll move on to the mailbag here. We're already very deep into this show. We didn't do a mailbag last week. We took live phone calls, which we may do more of in the future. I don't have everything set up just yet. I might be able to do that more often. I'm not quite sure yet how I would work that since I'm not in studio like I was last week. But we do have tons of mailbag questions to get to. So if you would like to send in a question, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Dylan James writes in, what do you think about AJ Styles versus Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania 33, with Bray going over and becoming champion? Who do you think would be face and heel in that rivalry? I am okay with that. That's not a terrible idea, only if Bray is the face. I think people are still just waiting for a reason to cheer for Bray Wyatt. I don't think they're going to do that in a feud with Randy Orton, but I do think you can build, as long as the guy can stay healthy. I mean, for Christ's sake, and they've tried this before and he keeps getting hurt, but if he can stay healthy, I think you just kind of organically let the fans get behind him. I don't want to see Bray, like, you know, save a fucking orphan from a burning building or anything like that to turn babyface. I don't think he should be doing stuff like that. But just organically, let the fans get behind the guy, and he would kind of be the de facto babyface, and AJ could be the cocky heel. And I'd be okay with that. I'd be okay with that. Although I will say, what I would really like to see, and now Finn Balor is hurt, so the whole idea of doing an interpromotional, like, Balor versus Styles match is probably out the window now. But what I would really like to see at WrestleMania, I'd like to see it next year at WrestleMania, but either 33 or 34. I want to see an AJ Styles Shinsuke Nakamura match at WrestleMania, because the match they had earlier this year at the Tokyo Dome was incredible, and they have great chemistry together. And to be able to then see them in front of another big crowd, even an even bigger crowd, at a WrestleMania, doing their thing in one of the top matches, they would tear the fucking house down. So I want to see Styles and Nakamura have a WrestleMania match, and I hope it happens. If it doesn't happen next year, I hope in 2018, hopefully we can get that match. Jacob from Reno, Nevada, how would you feel about Finn Balor as the Demon King returning to beat Brock Lesnar? I ask because I think it could work by saying that the Demon beat him, not Balor, technically. What do you think? You know, there was a time when I thought the whole David versus Goliath story could really work, like, really well, with Daniel Bryan against Brock Lesnar. And that's a match I really wanted to see at WrestleMania. But the idea of Balor and Lesnar at this point is laughable. They have built Brock Lesnar up so much. I mean, this guy destroyed two of that company's biggest stars at SummerSlam within 2 years of each other, okay? I said it earlier. The only guy to beat Lesnar, and I'm sure this is where this is headed, is Roman Reigns. The Reigns we saw at SummerSlam snapping on Rusev, okay, that's realistically the only guy I can see on the roster right now who can beat Lesnar at this point. Taking Joe and Nakamura out of the equation. I already talked about this earlier. And Joe ain't going to be the guy to do it. They're not building Lesnar up for years to be beaten by fucking Samoa Joe. It ain't going to happen. But the thing with Brock is they've almost built him up too well, to where nobody else is even close to being believable against this guy. And I don't care if Balor paints himself up or not. You know, him against Brock Lesnar, at this point, how could anybody take that seriously? Now, I didn't feel that way when CM Punk wrestled Brock. And CM Punk is, I don't know, weight-wise, he might weigh a little bit more than Balor does. When Punk wrestled Brock, I thought it would be a great match. I was looking forward to it. I bought into it. They had a very competitive match. They had a great match. They had arguably the match of the year in 2013. But that was 3 years ago. And since then, Brock has just beaten guys and beaten guys and beaten guys and bloodied them and has been built up so much. I mean, unless Balor paints himself up as a USADA drug tester, Lesnar is basically invincible at this point. So I don't think that match would work. Reeves, if I'm pronouncing that right, from Jamaica. I remember The Rock and Stone Cold winning the tag team belts on an episode of Raw in the early 2000s. I can't recall who they defeated for them, but I distinctly remember a tense moment after the match where Stone Cold and The Rock stared each other down in the middle of the ring with a beer in each hand. Stone Cold splashed a little of his beer on The Rock's title, and The Rock returned the favor. Then, instead of going at it, they turned and went up to the turnbuckles, did their signature poses, and celebrated with the fans before Raw went off the air. The problem is, I can't find any footage of this event online. Did this actually happen, or was this awesome ending to a Raw something I dreamed up on a Monday night after falling asleep? I think you dreamed it up, dude, because I don't ever remember Rock and Austin winning the tag titles. In fact, based on what you're describing, I think what you might be remembering is the finish to the Backlash match between Rock and Triple H when Austin came out. Because they did a little deal when the match was over, and Austin kind of, he saluted The Rock's title. He splashed it with the beer can. Rock had a beer. They both drank beers. They both went up and celebrated. Rock went to the turnbuckle. Austin left. That to me, is what that sounds like. I think you're thinking of Backlash, because they never won the tag team belts, dude. And you're talking early 2000s. That Backlash match was in April of 2000. Austin wasn't even wrestling in the early 2000s, or in 2000, I should say, because he was still out from the neck surgery. So even timeline-wise, I think you're talking about the Backlash match. And actually, it's kind of amazing to think about the fact that Austin and Rock never did win those tag team belts. For all the times that they feuded, and all the times they did that whole, like, opponents win the tag belts deal. Like, I know they did that with Austin and Undertaker. I know they won the belts. I know they did it with Rock and Chris Jericho. I know they won the belts. Even Rock and Undertaker at one point were tag team champions. But not Rock and Austin. I'm pretty sure they never did. Thomas from Lithuania. How about that? First Lithuania question. What do you think about Sid's career? Why is he not acknowledged as much as he should be? He was a very popular performer during the 90s. He had a great look. He became a two-time WWE champion, a two-time WCW champion. He made a couple of appearances in ECW. He headlined two WrestleManias. I think with these accomplishments, he should be acknowledged more as a pretty big legend. You know, I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. Even if you don't think much of Sid as a wrestler, you can't deny the fact that this guy was over. He had a lot of success in two different promotions. So he's as good of a candidate for the Hall of Fame as anybody. As far as why they don't acknowledge him more, I don't know. I mean, Sid always had a reputation, from what I read, as not being very, reliable. Like, people would try to book him in indie shows and appearances and stuff, and he would no-show. Even when he worked in WCW and WWE, I mean, think of all the times he left and came back, left and came back. There's a reason for that. He probably wasn't the easiest guy in the world to work with, or else he wouldn't have left and come back so many different times. So maybe that has something to do with it. I know he came in to do the match with Heath Slater on Raw a few years ago. They haven't done anything with him since. So, you know, maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe it's... And also, he was never known as the greatest wrestler. I always liked Sid because the guy, he did have a great look. And he had this intensity. Like, his promos, if you listen to his promos sucked. But in some ways, his promos were also quite awesome. Because he had an intensity about him that hardly anybody today has. I mean, find me somebody on the current WWE roster who can cut a promo with the intensity that Sid did. Like, The Miz tried on Talking Smack. So The Miz, of all people, may be the one who came the closest. But he was... he could be a lot of fun to watch. His promos... could be cringeworthy, but they could also just, they were different. That's the best thing I could say about them. And he was this larger-than-life guy. I love the powerbomb. Like, I'm a big fan of the powerbomb. I hate the fact that nobody really uses it now as a finish. It's just kind of like a setup move almost. I guess Kevin Owens has the pop-up powerbomb, but just the basic powerbomb, I really miss that. And the way Sid did it, he had his own way of doing it where he would pick you up and he would kind of hold you horizontal. And he would just drop you. And I like that. I don't know why, but I always was a fan of that. So I kind of like Sid. Yeah, I wish that he would be acknowledged more, I guess. But, you know, in what capacity? How should they acknowledge him? You know? It's not like he was a great champion. He wasn't a great wrestler. So how exactly would WWE acknowledge him, I guess, would be my question. More appearances? Okay, I guess you can make that argument. I'm not sure what he would do, but I do see him in the Hall of Fame one day. Brian from Orlando. My question is regarding Chris Jericho making his WWF debut in 1999. Before his arrival to WWE, WCW had taken him off TV in March of 99, and he only worked house shows and competed in Japan. Had Jericho been booked to lose and been made to look like a fool, do you think his debut would have been ruined, and he would have, or would not have, received the great reception that he got when he debuted on Raw? Or even AJ Styles, had he been in TNA 2 months before and constantly lost, would he have gotten the reaction he did at the Royal Rumble? It wouldn't have mattered. With those two guys, it wouldn't have mattered. I remember when Jericho was coming in, I remember vaguely Vince McMahon was invited to go to the UK. He was invited to Oxford. He was giving a lecture or a talk or something. And this would have been, I want to say this was in 98. This is probably in 98, not even 99. And I remember somebody asked him about Chris Jericho. Like, when are you going to sign Chris Jericho? And his reaction or his response was like, we're working on it. Like, Jericho was a popular, like, people wanted him in WWE. He was a really sought-after guy. And WWE had him on their radar for a while before they finally got him. So I think it almost just didn't even matter what Jericho did in WCW at that point. It's like, you know, they could have had him out there. Bischoff could have put him out there in a fucking chicken costume, like Miz wears in that KFC commercial, and he still would have gotten a big reaction on Raw. Same thing with AJ Styles. They could have had Claire Lynch pin him on Impact the week before he debuted at the Rumble, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because only, what, 300,000 people or so would have seen it? So, no, I don't think it would have mattered. I think people... I think people know the score. They know that these things... That's how these things work sometimes. Sometimes you get jobbed out on your way out. That's just how it works. All it would end up being is a poor reflection of the other company. Like once Chris Jericho walks out there on stage, and he is verbally going toe-to-toe with The Rock, okay? And you got millions of people watching this and just creaming their pants. They're watching this stuff. All it's going to do at that point is make people go, man, WCW sucks. They had this guy and that's what they did with him? Like, they squandered this guy doing stupid shit like that? It's not going to ruin Jericho. It's going to just ruin WCW's reputation. Like how stupid were the other guys for not doing anything with this guy? Brandon from Oklahoma. I watched Bad Blood in Your House tonight, basically to see The Undertaker, Shawn Michaels, Hell in a Cell match that holds a special place in my heart. However, my question is about the ending, where Undertaker is about to finish Shawn, and Kane comes out with Paul Bearer. It was so awesome the first time I saw it live on pay-per-view, and still is today. Is that not the most badass introduction of a new wrestler? I can't think of any other wrestlers that were introduced to fans in any fashion as cool as Kane's introduction was. What are your thoughts? I agree with you 100%. Kane, to me, is still the best debut in WWE history. Taz had a pretty badass debut. He walked out there in Madison Square Garden, and he was the first person to choke out Kurt Angle. Yeah, that's a pretty cool debut. But Kane coming out in that costume and the original mask and flames shooting up behind him and ripping a door off its hinges and laying out The Undertaker in his very first appearance, you know, to me, it doesn't get more badass than that. And also, that was the first time he did the whole thing with the flames shooting out of the ring posts. So, I mean, that whole debut... from start to finish was just totally badass. And to me, there hasn't been a better one since. Maybe in all of wrestling. Derek Jones, what do you think is the greatest WrestleMania main event of all time? While there have been some greats, it seems more often than not the last match of WrestleMania is underwhelming or flat-out horrible. See Miz versus Cena. What is the one last match to take place at a WrestleMania that stands out above the rest? Well, the younger me would say Hulk Hogan versus The Ultimate Warrior. And I still, to this day, I still think that's an epic match. To me, that match screams WrestleMania. You've got, first time we ever saw the world champion against the Intercontinental champion. You've got Hulk Hogan and The Ultimate Warrior, right? Two of the biggest baby faces of that whole golden era. Going one-on-one. You got 68,000 people, so they had the big stadium setting. You had Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura doing commentary. The second greatest announced duo in the history of that company. Behind only Gorilla and Bobby, and I'd probably put JR and King at number three. That's just me personally. So everything about that was, and the match they had, I mean, the match they had was actually better than you would expect it to be. So that's an epic match in every sense. But, you know, and I know a lot of people are going to reflexively say Stone Cold Rock 2, right? WrestleMania X7, without even thinking. And that match definitely had an epic feel to it. Not a great finish, but it was an epic match. But I'm not going to say either one of those matches. You're asking me what I think the greatest last match, like main event, real main event of WrestleMania was. I'm going to say Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker in WrestleMania 26. And I'm a bigger fan of their WrestleMania 25 match. I thought that was the better match. And if that was the last match on that card, which it probably should have been, that would have my vote. But this was a great match. It told a great story going in. I thought the build-up was great. The video package was great. You had two of the biggest stars on that roster. Two of the biggest stars in the history of that company. It was so much history between them. The match itself, I thought, was excellent. Even if it wasn't as good as the 25 match, it was still an excellent match. You had Shawn Michaels' career on the line. Right? The stakes couldn't be higher. I think those last 30 seconds or so of that match were just fantastic, with Shawn, like Undertaker, giving the cutthroat sign and stopping and looking down and almost having sympathy for Shawn, and Shawn is just pulling on Undertaker, trying to pull himself up, and he gives the cutthroat symbol and slaps the Undertaker, and Undertaker snaps. He gives him a jumping tombstone, like a super tombstone. I just thought that was just so great. And to me, it's hard to top that as a WrestleMania main event. That, to me, is what a WrestleMania main event should be. You have the star power, you have the story, you have a big stipulation, and you have a pretty goddamn great match. I mean, what more do you need? You know, and you have and Shawn got the big send-off, the big emotional send-off when it was all over. One of the few people to actually stick to his guns, to stick to a retirement stipulation. All these years later, he hasn't come back. So I look back on that match, and I think that right there is probably the greatest WrestleMania main event match of all time. And there's been a lot of great matches. You know, Shawn and Cena had a great match. The Triple Threat with Shawn and Triple H and Benoit, that was a great match. I'm more a fan of singles matches. I mean, that's just me personally. I love Daniel Bryan, Batista, and Randy Orton. I thought that was a great match. But I'm always going to be a little more biased towards singles matches. So, Shawn and Undertaker gets my vote. Kevin from Kentucky, buy or sell on John Cena's greatest rivalry, Edge or CM Punk? Which rivalry told a better story and was better in terms of match quality? The Edge feud, I thought, took John Cena to another level. It was definitely one of his best. They worked very well together. They had great chemistry. Edge was a great heel. Edge, when he took that SmackDown brand on his shoulders, he made the most of it. The best thing that could have happened to him was getting away from Raw and getting away from Triple H, which is what he wanted, and doing his thing on SmackDown. That was the best thing for his career. And him and Cena had a fantastic feud, and I guess it would have been, what, 06? Like 06, 07? And even when he initially won the championship at the beginning of the year from Cena, when he cashed in Money in the Bank, I thought it was a real slap in the face to not let him run to Mania with it, just because they had other plans. Because I think they could have actually built to a John Cena Edge WrestleMania main event that year. So they had a great feud, but I'm going to buy on Punk and I'm going to sell on Edge as Cena's best rivalry. You could not find two more polar opposites than John Cena and CM Punk. Cena was, he was the establishment, right? Punk was anti-establishment. Cena was the white meat babyface. Punk was the antithesis of white meat babyface, even though the people still loved him. Cena, in a way, it was like Cena kind of represented, he was like a more modern day version of what Hogan was to all the kids and everything back in the day. And Punk was more Stone Cold to Cena's Hogan. Cena had no tattoos. Punk had tattoos all over. I mean, you could come up with a bunch of other differences between the two of them. And the matches they had were some of the best in WWE, I think, in the last decade. These two brought out the best in each other. I can remember reading It was on one of the sites or newsletters or something after their SummerSlam match. And I didn't like their SummerSlam match nearly as much as I liked their Money in the Bank match. But Punk went away for like a week. He came back. They had the rematch at SummerSlam in 2011. And I remember reading that John Cena was so thrilled with that match. Like, when he went back to the locker room that night, he was so happy because he knew, wow, we had a great match. Like, he loved working with CM Punk, and you could see it. I mean, they had chemistry together. They brought out the best in each other, and I think because they were such polar opposites, that helped a lot. They weren't clones of each other. For all the matches that John Cena had with Randy Orton, and on commentary, we heard, like, back in the day, Michael Cole, oh, this is the greatest, like, the greatest feud of the modern era, the modern generation, Cena and Orton. And I said then, and I'll say it now, you can have a million matches. It's not a matter of how many matches you have, it's the quality of those matches. And John Cena and Randy Orton had some pretty good matches. But by no means is John Cena and Randy Orton the fucking feud of this era, or the fucking feud of this generation. I mean, that's just bullshit. I would take Cena and Edge, I would take Cena and Orton, or Cena and Punk, I should say, over Cena and Orton any day of the week. Okay, it's not a matter of quantity here. So I got to buy on the Punk feud. I just thought that was his best. So we're 2 hours in here. We'll wrap this up. If you have questions, you can continue to email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter. @Solemonster is my handle as we approach nearly 19,000 followers. And you can check out my live tweets during Raw on Monday night. SmackDown, when I have the chance to watch it live. Usually I don't watch it live. But I put a poll up after Raw at least every Monday night. Thumbs up, thumbs down, that you can vote in. I try to do it for SmackDown when I can. I'm not always around. But definitely check that out. If you'd like to make a PayPal donation, if you like what you heard, you can make a donation to the show if you want to. $10 or more, get yourself a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the air. You can go to thesolemonster.com to do that. You can use our Audible link if you want to show us some support that way and get yourself a free audiobook, audibletrial.com/solemonster. Please check out our YouTube channel. I have got a ton of Sound Off Extra bonus audio up there. New Sound Off Gamer videos, a ton of interviews that I've done in recent weeks with Diamond Dallas Page and Bob Holly, which is still getting rave reviews. You guys are still sending tweets to Bob at TheBobHolly. Again, he reads and responds to everything you send him. He's been blown away, I'm sure, by the response. I've been blown away by the response to that interview. I'm sure we'll get him back on in the future, so check that out. My interview with Bill Apter is up there as well. A lot of the older ones I've done, and also the interviews I was able to get last week at the 2K17 launch. You could check that out as well. I love, if you want to hear that Miz interview I did and the question I asked about the Intercontinental title, that's up there. I got a great 4 or 5 minutes with AJ Styles, so please subscribe to the YouTube channel if you have not already done so. You can find links all over my Facebook and Twitter and just go to the channel that way, but I'm sure if you type in Solemonster Sounds Off in the search bar on YouTube, you'll see the channel. It'll probably be the first thing that comes up. And leave some love for the show in iTunes and Stitcher. You can leave a review. We are a 5-star rated podcast. We have a free app. If you are an Android user in the Google Play Store, you can get our free app and stream us that way. You can stream us for free using the Podbean app. Tons and tons of different ways to listen to this podcast every single week. And I thank you for all of your support. I thank everybody who came out to our meetup last weekend. We'll be back next weekend, episode 459. We'll have a brand new podcast. I can't believe the summer's almost over. It's kind of depressing, actually. So, 19 pay-per-views a year for WWE now. There's a lot of shows coming up. So, until next time, be well, stay safe, and we will see you back here next weekend for a brand new podcast. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters, sound off!